The next case is 06-1429, Board of Education of the Columbus City Schools versus the Franklin County Board of Revision. Mr. Sleggs.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Todd Sleggs, and I represent the appellant, 2100 Maple Canyon LLC. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This appeal comes to the court from the Ohio Board of Tax Appeals and involves the real property tax assessment of an 11,384 square foot CVS drugstore on East Dublin Granville Road in Columbus, Ohio for the tax year 2003. This action was initiated in a complaint that was filed by the Appalachian Board of Education seeking to assess the property based upon a July 1st, 2003 sale of the property. The county auditor had assessed the property at a fair market value of $1,760,000, and at the time of the Board of Revision, the taxpayer and the appellant in this case submitted an appraisal valuing the fee simple real estate at $1 million. The Board of Revision decision was appealed by the Board of Education to the Ohio Board of Tax Appeals, and the Board of Tax Appeals, following this court's decision in Berea, assessed the property based upon the July 2003 sale. We have appealed that decision to this court because we believe that it is unreasonable and unlawful. And we believe that the central issue in this case is uniformity of taxation. I cited the court to a case that I was before this court on 10 years ago, which is the New Winchester Gardens case, which involved the sale of a subsidized apartment project, which this court recognized involved not just the sale of the real estate, but also the HUD subsidy contract that transferred as a result of that sale. I feel that the facts in that case are identical to the facts in this appeal, with the exception that we're dealing with a drugstore subject to a long-term lease.
Wouldn't a HUD subsidy be remarkably different, though, than a lease to a, I assume CVS is a viable company? I mean, these folks who pay a lot of money to be on the hottest corner in town, some of them have overpaid and gotten a couple of chains in trouble, in which case the lease wouldn't then be so valuable because you're wondering how long they're going to be around. But in a HUD subsidy case, the new owner has to do a number of things ongoing to keep that going, independent of the real estate. Or they could lose the subsidy, could they not?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think the landlord in this particular case has certain responsibilities to the tenant as well. If you look at the lease abstract in this case, they need to maintain the property in order to comply with the lease and keep, you know, CVS as a tenant. So I don't think that the two...
It's a standard triple net lease, though, is it?
Not in this particular case, Your Honor, because there is an adjacent shopping center that's part of the property, there's connecting driveways, there is some landlord responsibility for maintenance and certain exterior cleaning and that sort of thing that covers not only this site but the adjacent site. So it's not an absolute triple net lease in that sense, although it is very close.
Were you aware of the arguments we had last week about the sale of a storage unit where they tried to assess some to the fee simple and some to goodwill for the ongoing business?
Yes.
Is there any difference between that analysis and this, where there is a factor given to land and then a factor given to the business on the land, which in this case is the rental to CVS?
Well, I think in this particular case, Your Honor, is there is an objective methodology in order to quantify the value of the lease in this particular case, just as there was in the New Winchester Gardens case, because in both instances, the court directed and the appraisers in New Winchester Gardens in this case looked to see what market rent would be. And the value differential was what was market rent versus contract rent. In the St. Bernard storage case that you reference, I don't believe that there was a way to objectively go to the market and quantify the goodwill or the business value in the way that it was done in this case and the way that it was done in New Winchester Gardens. So I think that there are some similarities, but I think the proof and the evidence in the cases was different in this appeal and the St. Bernard appeal.
We have a lot of cases involving sales of large office buildings that come before us. If we accept your standard of the valuation of fee simple versus rents, will those buildings then have to separate out all the values of the rents and categorize them in a separate category? Because all the cases I remember, that was all part of the value of the building was the fact that they were leasable and had good leases.
Yeah, not if the leases are at market. And I think some of the cases that we've cited in our brief, the South Euclid Lyndhurst Board of Education case, the Cleveland Heights, University Heights case, and they cite the Kroger case, the courts always look to see what the lease terms were. In the South Euclid case, they were below market, so the sale was not a reliable indicator of fee simple value. And in the Cleveland University Heights case, it was essentially a financing transaction. In your example, the office building sale, I think you would still want to look to make sure that the leases were at market, or just as in South Euclid Lyndhurst, you didn't have a bank who occupied a significant portion of the property at a below market rent.
So you say this one is over market.
Yes.
And are we permitted to, or is the BOR permitted to take the over-market difference between the market rents and apply that, and only the difference between market and what good deal you got is taken out?
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason why is if you look at Section 5713.03, the very introductory portion of that section of the code says that the county auditor is to value the real property and the building structures and improvements thereon. And then those particular terms are defined in 5701.02. And they don't include in either that section or the definitional section leases. And I did cite the court in my notice of additional authority to the only cases close to this issue that I could find, which are the Visicon and the Lockbourne cases, where the court recognized that we don't tax lease hold values in Ohio. And essentially what has been taxed in this case is, as I mentioned, just like New Winchester Gardens, the real estate and also the contract that transferred, which in this case was above market. And so we feel that in order for there to be uniformity of taxation, that you have to disregard the above market contract rent in order to make sure that all real property is assessed uniformly. And the court really identified it on page 45 in New Winchester Gardens that what we're concerned about and what the court was concerned about in Canton Towers and Alliance Towers is if you had two identical properties and one, as was the case in New Winchester Gardens, sold with that subsidy contract in place that inflated the real estate value, that you wouldn't have a situation where they were assessed more than a property that hadn't sold.
But and the lease isn't in evidence. It wasn't submitted to the Board of Revision or to the Board of Tax Appeals. I think that's what the school is arguing.
The
how are we to determine this?
The lease abstract was submitted to the Board of Revision. There was an affidavit from the tenant that this was the lease. These were the lease terms, and those were the lease terms that were in place at the time of the July 1st, 2003 sale and also the July 16th, 2004 sale. And there was no objection to our submitting that information at the Board of Revision.
So is the, assuming that we agree with your position, then are we now going to get apartment buildings and take all the leases from all of the tenants and subtract those from the land, or if you have a parking garage with monthly parking in it, take the value of all the leases and separate that from the value of the land? Is that the new direction then for?
No, Your Honor, because clearly if the leases are at market, then there is no problem with the leases. But it's in these situations where you have a lease because it's a sale leaseback, or in this case, there's a significant discussion by Mr. Lorms with respect to the nature of the build-to-suit market.
But you just argued to us that the definitional section in 5713 doesn't include leases.
It doesn't include leasehold value. I cited the court to the appraisal of Institute guidelines for appraisers when valuing fee simple. And they say you need to look at the leases to make sure that you are not capturing a leased fee value that exceeds the fee simple value of the real estate. And that was really the focus of the court in the New Winchester Gardens case, was to ensure that we were taxing only the fee simple value, because that is what that introductory language of 5713.03 captures. That is what the auditor is supposed to assess. And when you go back to the definitional sections where each of those incremental items are defined, it does not include leases or leasehold interest. But clearly, if you have income-producing property, there will be, in many instances, leases in effect. But the question is, as presented in this case, is whether those leases are above market or below market.
Mr. Sleggs, didn't we include that discussion in the Berea case, though? There were leases involved in that situation as well, and we held that it was the arm's length sale between the parties that would control. Why doesn't Berea apply?
Because in Berea, Your Honor, you were only taxing the real estate. You weren't taxing the real estate in a contract. There was the lease had no value. In fact, arguably, I read the briefs in that case, the argument was that the leases actually negatively impacted the value of the property. So there wasn't a positive leased fee value that was at issue in Berea. So your decision clearly did not tax more than what 5713.03 allows. But in this case, just like New Winchester Gardens, the lease has a positive value. It is a contract on this property that has significant value because it is so far above the market. And so, as the court recognized in New Winchester Gardens, we need to eliminate that value so that we can ensure that there's uniformity of taxation.
And just so I understand, the purchase agreement between the parties, did it break out the lease payments as opposed to the payments for the real estate?
No, Your Honor, and that's because the lease was already in place at the time of the sale. I mean, the lease was with the tenant, and the sale occurred between the, you know, the buyer and the seller. The
but
property.
If we look at the purchase agreement in and of itself, as Berea seems to suggest that we do, that's what the board found here, that should be the value of the property.
Well, I would go again back to New Winchester Gardens, where the court said that when you have a contract that transfers with real estate, you can do one of two things. You can value the contract and subtract that from the sale price, or you can do what the taxpayer did in New Winchester Gardens, and what the taxpayer did in this case was essentially submit a fee simple appraisal of the property unencumbered by the lease. And so there are essentially two ways that you can ensure that you're not taxing more than the fee simple value. Mm-hmm. I'd like to touch just very quickly on the jurisdictional issue that was raised in
this
case.
Yeah, I'd like to hear your argument on the jurisdictional issue. That's a threshold issue, I think.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to point out, and I did in my introductory comments, is that the transaction that gave rise to this litigation was a transaction involving my client. All the facts behind the school board bringing the complaint involved my client. Public Square Tower 1 that I cite in my brief says that ownership is tested at the time the assessment complaint was filed. We owned the property for all of calendar year 2003. By the time we sold it in July of 2004, we had paid the 2003 taxes that are at issue, and the transaction that we were involved in serves as the basis for the Board of Education's complaint in this case. I think we are an indispensable party in this case, because if Ted and Maria were before this court, they would have no knowledge or ability to comment on the transaction that served as the basis for the school board's complaint. And for that reason, I feel that our appeal to this court was proper. We were clearly an appropriate party before the Board of Tax Appeals, and the school board's motion to dismiss our appeal is improper.
Was notice served pursuant to 57-1704, paragraph 6, which requires that the appellant, somebody appealing from the Board of Tax Appeals to this court, must serve all the appellees. Was that done in this case?
Yes. It's in our proof of service, Your Honor.
And that includes the other owner of the property, or the property, the one presumptively listed as the owner at the time that you appealed?
No, we viewed us as being the owner of the property and bringing the appeal to this court.
Okay.
Under Public Square Tower 1, Your Honor.
But you were not the owner at the time the Board of Tax Appeals rendered its decision. Is that correct or not?
That's correct. At that time, by that time, the property had transferred.
So why shouldn't the entity in whose name the property was listed at the time of the appeal, why shouldn't that entity be served with a notice of the appeal?
Well, Your Honor,
to the statute.
Well, as I say, based upon Public Tower 1 says that the test for ownership is at the time the complaint is filed. The tax period at issue in this appeal was the tax period that we owned the property, we paid the property taxes, and then subsequently the property was sold. We did also raise before the Board of Tax Appeals the fact that we never received notice under the statute, and we actually moved to dismiss the Board of Education's appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals for the notice issues that are addressed in our brief. And so, we would request that the court consider that, and we did ask that for relief and that their appeal and the underlying complaint be dismissed as part of our appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Sleggs. Mr. Rich.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Jeffrey Rich. I'm here today on behalf of the Columbus Board of Education. All but up until the last 2 minutes when the yellow light went on was irrelevant argument for today's case. The first issue is jurisdictional, as the Chief Justice correctly stated it. Let me go through the facts that are relevant to that. On 3/30 of 2004, the Columbus Board of Education filed a complaint based on a sale between Maple Canyon Limited and 2100 Maple Canyon Plaza, LLC. Attached to that complaint at the time of filing was a copy of the deed and the conveyance form. The address on the complaint form was that taken directly from the auditor's tax duplicate and the treasurer's tax duplicate showing on 3/30 of 04 the tax mailing address for the property. 3.5 months later, the property was sold to Ted and Maria's Plaza, LLC. When the notice of hearing was sent from the Board of Revision for a February 17th of 05 hearing, it was sent to Ted and Maria's Plaza as required by statute. When the decision was entered on March 16th of 2005, the decision was sent, as required by law, to the owner of the property, Ted and Maria's Plaza. The appellant here attempted then to appeal this case to the Board of Tax Appeals, and the Board of Tax Appeals ultimately reversed based on your Berea case and determined that the fair market value was the value determined by that sale upon which our complaint for tax year 2003 was based. Now, 2100 attempts to appeal to this court. And of course, as the Chief Justice indicated, they totally violated Section 57-1704, which could not be clearer. That section says that the party who files an appeal from the Board of Tax Appeals to the Supreme Court must name and serve all of the parties appropriate, including the person in whose name the property is listed and the complainant. Now, the notice of appeal does not name Ted and Marie's Limited. It does not show that service was made upon them. This court, within the last year, decided a case on 57-17-04. In the Olympic Steel case, you made it very clear that joinder and service requirements in that section are, as you said, mandatory and jurisdictional. Failure to name and serve the tax commissioner in that case resulted in the dismissal of the appeal, and as you know, sua sponte, dozens and dozens of other cases throughout the state of Ohio where a similar failure had occurred. We would suggest to this honorable court that there is no way that the current owner of the property is somehow less important a party to this court's proceeding than the tax commissioner, who, as you know, is not even here today. So we would suggest that that is dispositive. There are no substantive issues on valuation before you. What is before you is whether or not they have a right to be there, even if they would have named Ted and Maria.
If we find that there is jurisdiction and we can go forward with the case, who pays the ultimate tax?
That's by contract. We have no idea, nor does the court, nor does the record. Who knows what happened at closing when Ted and Maria bought it? We don't know that. We don't care about that. That's irrelevant. Who pays the ultimate tax? The tax is levied against property, not against people or corporations or businesses. It's a lien against property. It's different than income tax, which is lien against people. Real property tax, a lien against property. Whatever they contractually agree to is irrelevant. They might have some deal on the side, or, you know, we don't know and we don't care, and it's irrelevant to this proceeding. But even if Ted Maria would have been named, and even if they would have served them in their notice of appeal, they had no right to be at the BTA. Because, as I stated, 3.5 months after we filed our complaint, they sold the property. They never filed a counter-complaint, so they were never a complainant. They weren't an owner. So at the time of the decision of the Board of Revision, which was well over a year later, they had no right to appeal that decision to the Ohio Board of Tax Appeals, because the statute allowing for appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals says very clearly that the complainant and the owner are the parties who may appeal. They're not a complainant, and they weren't an owner. Therefore, substantive issues on valuation, though interesting they may be, have nothing to do with what you have to decide today, Your Honor.
Well, humor me with a little academic exercise then.
Be happy to, Your Honor.
It seems to me that in other cases, school boards and others who appeal saying that the taxes aren't high enough want to argue from time to time that the lease is way below market, and so the appraised value or the auditor's valuation is under the money because the lease, even though the property's tied up with a lengthy lease, is now way below market. Is that not true?
I can't speak for all other cases. I can tell you that there's
Well, haven't you argued that?
Have I argued that?
Yeah.
Not that I recall.
Okay.
But I can tell you that on the income approach to basis, to base a valuation, there are three approaches. There's the market sale approach,
I think we understand
cost
that.
Approach, and then there's the income approach. We look at leases, we look at cash flows, and we try to determine what an investor would want as a return on investment and therefore to purchase the property.
Right. So here the lease with a prime tenant, and presumably a lengthy lease, is driven the value of this. Somebody who's willing to pay a lot of money, probably a lot more than this building is worth if it's sitting there empty because of the lease. Would it then be fair, as the lease spins on out, now let's say it's a 20-year lease and we're 10 years down the road or 15 years down the road, there's just 5 years left. Does the value of the building then come down because the occupancy and the what the future holds is now pretty murky?
Well, Your Honor, for real property tax purposes, property is appraised fee simple, unencumbered. That's the law of Ohio. If you're talking as an investor, which would be irrelevant to this case, because we're not talking about an investor value, we're talking about...
Well, aren't we?
We're talking about...
The sale price represents investor value, doesn't it?
Sale price represents, by statute and by determination of this court, the value that the auditors shall use.
I'm talking real world. It represents the investor value placed on this.
It represents what, at that particular time, that particular buyer and seller agreed to.
Right. And that would be investor value.
If it's an investor, yes.
Presumably, these people didn't buy it because they liked the looks of the building.
Presumably, they bought it as an investment, as do most commercial enterprises.
Right.
But the point is, in this case, though exciting as it is to discuss this, and I would love to discuss it forever because it's quite interesting.
I'm sure you would.
A great deal of that. But in this case, we don't even get to those issues because of the procedural issues. This case absolutely should not be here, has no right to be here, had no right to appeal from the BTA. And if they wanted to get to these issues, as interesting as they were, they should have done it the legal way. If there's no more questions, that's all I have. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Rich. Mr. Slags, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points. We serve the tax commissioner. I think there was an implication that the tax commissioner was not here because of lack of service. It's in all our documentation. CVS pays the real estate taxes under the lease. That's in the record.
Was there any objection to your appearance at either the BTA level or?
No, Your Honor, and I would like to correct. We did not appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals. The Board of Education did, and they named 2100 Maple Canyon Plaza as an appellee in their notice of appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals, and there was no objection to our participation in that level. And as I mentioned before, this case involves a transaction that was started, and we were clearly a party to the transaction that serves as the basis for this appeal. I think
counsel,
we're an indispensable
counsel, are you saying
party.
Your participation at the lower levels cures any notice failing for a petition to this court?
I think we're an indispensable party, Your Honor. And as an indispensable party before the Board of Tax Appeals, 5715.04 says all parties to the Board of Tax Appeals have an appeal right to this court. And I think as an indispensable party before the Board of Tax Appeals that we clearly had an appeal right under the statute to come before.
You have a right to appeal, but the question is, did you perfect your appeal properly?
Right.
That's the issue.
Right, and we're in privity with Ted and Maria's Plaza.
But the statute doesn't say anything about privity.
But we're the property owner, Public Square Tower 1.
You were at the time that the tax accrued, but at the time of the appeal to this court, who was the owner?
Ted and Maria's Plaza.
And they didn't get the notice.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that becomes a jurisdictional defect, does it not?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because we are the property owner for purposes of
this litigation. It doesn't say in the statute, at least the way I read it, the property owner at the time the tax was assessed back in, 2003? It just says the property owner, presumably at the time of the appeal.
Well, I believe, based upon the Public Square Tower 1 decision, that as the owner at the time that the assessment complaint was filed and through the course of the attempts by the County Board of Revision to give us notice, which we never did receive notice, which is, by the way, the reason why no countercomplaint was ever filed, is because we never received notice of the school board's complaint under the statute. And we did raise that in a motion to dismiss that was denied by the Board of Tax Appeals. So the reason why we did not file a countercomplaint with the Board of Revision was the fact that we didn't receive the notice under the statute. Then, when the case was appealed by the Board of Education to the Board of Tax Appeals, we were a named party in their notice of appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals. We participated in that at that level, and as the owner of the property at the time that this action arose, we believe that we had proper standing to then appeal the Board of Tax Appeals decision, because the statute talks
about... So basically you're saying that Ted and Maria did not need to receive notice of the appeal to the Supreme Court?
Well, we believe that we stand in the shoes of Ted and Maria.
So
and
this basically,
based upon the fact
you say that Ted and Maria did not need, pursuant to 5717.04, Section 6, receive notice.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Sleggs. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.